From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. By the year 2100, sea levels could rise 3 to 6 feet. That's according to a study published in the scientific journal Nature just this month. One of the major contributors, ice melting in Antarctica. Reuters reports the continent lost almost 3 trillion tons of ice between 1992 and 2017. And the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free during the summer by mid-century, according to the New York Times. The reason, say researchers, young ice is melting before it has the chance to grow and thicken over the years. The way researchers create climate models and integrate the melting ice from Antarctica, the Arctic, Greenland, and large icebergs is complicated. And that's where Till Wagner's research comes in. As assistant professor of physics and physical oceanography at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, he just received a National Science Foundation grant shared with researchers at Princeton University and the University of California, San Diego to study the impact of icebergs on the climate. And he joins us now. Till Wagner, welcome to Coastline.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. What would you like to know about how Arctic and Antarctic ice is behaving and what are the implications for the global climate system? You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Till Wagner, so many people have heard about the melting of the polar ice cap contributing to sea level rise. And they may not know what that really means on a practical level. And you study ice in a number of different forms in these regions. So take us back to the beginning of the story and explain to us first how ice shows up in the Arctic and Antarctic.
Okay, so the Arctic and Antarctic are fundamentally different. The Arctic is mostly an ocean. With the exception of really Greenland, which is a landmass that is covered with land ice. The Arctic basin itself is actually just ocean covered with sea ice, what we call sea ice. So sea ice is essentially just frozen ocean water. And it doesn't grow very thick. Sea ice, on average, is maybe 1 to 2 meters thick. And it floats on top of the ocean and covers most of the Arctic basin. Antarctica and Greenland are land masses that are very... The ice on those land masses are very different because those ice masses form by snow falling over thousands and thousands of years. And over time, the snow compacts and becomes ice. And those ice masses grow much, much thicker. Up to, in Antarctica, up to 4 kilometers.
Now, icebergs, that's a different thing. How do those show up?
Yeah, okay, so we have sea ice in the Arctic. We have land ice, what we call ice sheets, covering Antarctica and Greenland. Now, these ice sheets, over time, sort of, the form of ice over long time scales is almost a bit like honey. It starts flowing. Yeah, so if you look at it straight up right now, it's a solid. It's very hard. But over time, over long time scales, it creeps and it starts flowing into the oceans. And so as it flows off the Antarctic continent into the ocean, at some point it will break up at the margins. And then when those pieces break off and start floating in the ocean, that's what an iceberg is.
So this is going to sound like a really dumb question, and there will probably be many of these coming from me during this hour.
I don't think so.
But you're talking about the ice sheet flowing. Is mm-hmm. it still in ice form?
It's still in ice form. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's sort of the conceptually difficult component of it, is that if you just look at it in a snapshot, it looks like a solid. But over longer timescales, over the... You know, if you basically took a time-lapse camera of the ice sheet over a couple of years, you would see, you know, and we talk about glaciers flowing, and it's just that ice behaves like a viscous fluid over long timescales.
And so we've heard from these studies, you know, national headlines, international headlines, trumpeting this accelerated ice melt that is happening. We're talking about the ice sheets. We're talking about land ice, mm-hmm. correct?
Yes.
Now, how does, well, first of all, tell us how much the ice melting in Antarctica and Greenland, how much that has accelerated.
Right. So there's certain, it's very difficult to measure. These ice sheets are huge. It's very difficult to get there. So we do most of our observations through satellites. And the satellites only have been around for a few decades. So to get sort of long-term measurements can be challenging. But we know that, so the way we measure the ice melt is usually in what we call meters or centimeters of sea level rise equivalent. Yeah. So every ton of ice that you lose from the ice sheet will contribute to the mass of the global oceans and raise the sea level a tiny bit.
And do we know how much?
Exactly.
Does each ton equal a certain?
Yeah, we know roughly how much, you know, and usually we talk in like billion gigatons or something, like not billion, but like billion tons, like huge amounts of ice. And then we translate that to meters of sea level rise. So we know that since 1880, the sea level has risen on a global mean by about 8 to 9 inches. Now that might sound a lot or a little, but what's very striking about it is how much that rate has increased.
Right, and that is striking because you're saying 1880, so a little more than 100 years ago.
Exactly. So, thing is that we know that 3 of those inches were in the last 25 years, so since 93. So we know that between 1900 and 1950, sea level has risen by about 1.4 millimeters per year. Yeah, that might not sound a lot, but since 2012, so over the last 5 years, this has tripled. It's about 4.5 meters per year now.
Is that sea level
millimeters,
rise?
Millimeters per
gotcha.
Year.
Is that acceleration entirely due to the ice melt from Antarctica and Greenland? Or are there other factors?
Yeah, so sea level rise is a very complicated phenomenon. And, you know, we always hear these numbers and they are averages over the whole global mean. There's ocean currents change as the climate changes. So that will lead to sea level rise being much worse in some areas around the globe and not so much in other areas. And there's two main contributors to sea level rise. One is the melting of the ice sheets. And the other one is actually that the oceans, as they are getting warmer, as water gets warmer, it expands a little. And so we estimate that roughly half of global sea level rise is due to the water expanding. And the other half is due to Greenland and Antarctica melting.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with ice and climate physicist Till Wagner. He's leading a team of researchers from Princeton University, UC San Diego, and the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where he works in the Physics and Physical Oceanography Department. The group was recently awarded a grant from the National Science Foundation to study the impact of icebergs on climate. You can ask your own question during this live Wednesday edition of Coastline by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. You've said then that it's the melting of the ice sheets that is one of the contributors, one of the major contributors to sea level rise. Does the melting of sea ice contribute to sea level rise?
Yeah, not really. So there's this whole thing, we call it Archimedes principle, that a floating object, I'm going to probably get this slightly wrong the way he's formulated it, but it's basically you say a floating object displaces its own weight in the volume of water. Yeah, so that means because it's already floating, when it melts, it doesn't add additional mass. It doesn't add additional volume to the ocean. So sea ice, because it's already floating, it's like if you have a cocktail glass and you have a bunch of, you know, you fill it right to the rim with, and you have some ice cubes in there. Over time, those ice cubes will melt, and your cocktail glass will not overflow. So sea ice does not raise sea levels if it melts. However, it does have large consequences for the global climate in other ways.
And we're going to unpack some of that in a moment. But just more terminology, even when we're talking about sea ice, we're talking about that thin layer of frozen water over the sea. We are not also talking about icebergs. That is a separate...
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And so you have to picture sea ice really as like a very thin film of ice covering the Arctic Ocean. Icebergs are much more chunky. So icebergs, you know, when they break off the ice sheet, they can be up to 1,000 meters thick. Sea ice is usually 2 meters thick. Sometimes it bunches up, it gets compressed by the winds, and then it can grow up to like 30 or 40 meters thick. But otherwise, sea ice is much thinner than the icebergs.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're learning about the behavior of sea ice, land ice, what that means for sea level rise. Till Wagner, ice and climate physicist, is with us today, and he's answering your questions. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from at least one listener. If you have questions about what the conditions in Antarctica and the polar regions mean for the globe, you can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're exploring icebergs, ice sheets, sea ice, and how it affects the global climate picture. Till Wagner is an assistant professor at UNCW in the Physics and Physical Oceanography Department, and he leads a multi-institutional research team that is exploring the role of icebergs in the climate system. The project has grants of nearly $600,000 through the National Science Foundation Office of Polar Programs. And he's answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can reach us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org, and we will get to a question in just a moment about flooding here in the Cape Fear region. But first, let's go back to icebergs and how they behave. Just before we went to break, you explained why the melting of sea ice does not contribute to sea level rise. You would also say that's true of icebergs. However, some icebergs are large enough that you've said they carry their own microclimate with them, mm-hmm. and they have a different kind of impact. Tell us about that.
So icebergs, they can be huge. The really big ones, we give them names. Yeah. So there's this iceberg called B15, which broke off the Ross Ice Shelf in 2000, and it's about the size of, or it was, you know, this is 18 years ago, initially it was about the size of Delaware. So that's a moving piece of ice floating in the ocean the size of an entire state. So it's not a surprise that an iceberg that big carries a lot of, it's very cold, and it carries a lot of fresh water. So as these icebergs drift away from the Antarctic continent, they can, as they melt and inject all that fresh water into the salty ocean background, they can change the local overturning circulation. They have profound impacts on the ecosystem, etc. And we don't really understand very well yet what exactly those effects are.
But it would you say it affects the ecosystem, so meaning it would affect some of the animals that can live in that environment.
Right. So we know that that these icebergs and the way that they melt actually can trigger a lot of primary productivity in their wake. So we've seen from satellite images that sort of the trail behind the iceberg can actually grow a lot of phytoplankton and other algae and animals and plants.
The injection of the fresh water allows more phytoplankton and algae to grow.
Yeah. So there is like, it's complicated and we don't really understand how exactly it all works. And also, I'm not a biologist, so this is like way outside my comfort zone. But, you know, like the fresh water also, it's cold, it's fresh, so it stabilizes the top layer of the water column, so it can suppress convection and overturning, which then has impacts on the flora and fauna.
We have a question. Robert writes, New Hanover County is surrounded on three sides by tidally influenced waters. Most of our water-dependent infrastructure and much of our recent development is located on the changing shoreline boundary. What is your best estimate for the amount of sea level rise to expect in New Hanover County in 2050 and 2100?
Yeah. Okay, so I just moved to Wilmington 6 months ago, so I can't, unfortunately, claim to be an expert in the region. But I did look recently. There was a report that came out by the Union of Concerned Scientists recently, and there was and they looked at individual zip codes and county lines and looking at how much of the infrastructure will be impacted, and they estimated that under a scenario where we have 2 feet of sea level rise by 2100, which is, you know, not an extreme scenario at all. By that scenario, you will have chronic inundation in Topsail Beach that might affect up to 10,000 houses by 2045, which is within, you know, that's the sort of the horizon of a mortgage rate. Yeah, if you buy a house today, you will likely be paying mortgage until 2045. At that point, your house might be chronically inundated, which means flooded at high tide more than 26 times a year.
We're going to talk about that a little bit more. I do want to get to how you conduct your research. You've been on a few expeditions to the Antarctic and want to talk about the advantages of going and what's also limiting about that. But first, we're going to hear from Sean from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, Sean. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Rachel. Thank you for having me on the air. And what a great program on this hot day. My question is an ecotourism question. First, what is the greatest memory you have or a spot you can recall where you were just totally taken away by the visual stimulus of where you were in the ice region? And then secondly, where would one plan a trip, or could you recommend one to plan a trip to go to see such a beautiful thing? And I'll take my question off the air, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Sean, and thanks for those good questions. Yeah. So what was so striking when you first arrived?
So I had this one moment of sort of like a profound realization. We were in 2011 doing a sea ice cruise in Antarctica off the West Antarctic Peninsula, and my job was a little mundane. I had basically a measuring stick, and I was walking around the ice and measuring the thickness of the snow on top of the ice. So I would all day walk around poking the stick into the snow and looking how, and we do these experiments. We need to do that to mostly validate and calibrate satellite measurements. So you need to ground truth them. So I was walking around there and at some point I was kind of alone by my ice, a few hundred meters away from the ship. And you know, I'm standing on very thin sea ice, a couple of meters thick. But sort of it was bright sunny day. I was wearing a full face mask because you get sunburned and snow goggles. And in the horizon, I saw the mountains at the coastline of the Antarctic Peninsula. And otherwise, I saw nothing really. It was just these. It was just white, and then mountains and the sun. And I felt like this must be about as close to being on the moon as you can get on this planet. So I think that that's sort of what makes these. It just the purity and the vastness of the landscape is incredible.
Now, if someone were to travel to that area, not as a researcher, but as an ecotourist.
Yeah. So Antarctica is very difficult to get to. You can totally. There's an increasing number of tours that provide these. They're very expensive. You have to first fly to Chile or Argentina and then get on a boat and spend days on a ship crossing the Drake Passage, which is like the worst waves on the planet. So that's a challenge. I mean, for whoever can afford that, it's amazing. But you don't have to travel that far. You can experience beautiful ice landscapes just off the coast of Alaska. And also Greenland can be much more accessible. And a place that I've been to a couple of times is just north of Norway. You can get to Norway and then fly about an hour north to this archipelago called Svalbard. And there's a ton of glaciers and ice very close by.
As Sean talked about sweltering under a heat advisory today, and I think the National Weather Service says heat indices could possibly reach 108 on this Wednesday. I just took a quick peek at temperature monitoring stations around the continent of Antarctica.
Uh-huh.
And they seem to range from a balmy 14 degrees to minus 45 degrees. What is the season in Antarctica now?
So let me think. What do we have right now? It's June. Yeah, so it's kind of early to mid-winter down there. They probably don't have... Yeah, they don't. If you are the further you get south, you won't have any sunlight. It's probably stormy and very uncomfortable outside. But it's nice to sort of channel that a little bit on a day like today and sort of just think, oh, that would, yeah. No, it wouldn't be comfortable right now.
And so you've been to that area three times?
I've been to the Antarctic on one extended cruise, 2 months, and to the Arctic three times.
Yeah. To the Arctic three times. Mm-hmm. Your extended cruise, you said, was 2 months.
On a boat, yeah. You run out of fresh vegetables after about 6 weeks or so, and then it's just, I don't know, yeah, tins and less exciting food.
So at what point does it stop being exciting and not just because of the food? And at what point do you really just get ready to get out of that kind of barren?
Yeah, I think it's sort of personality dependent. And at the time, I didn't have a family either, so I could have stayed. There was actually, we stopped at the British Research Station on Rothera on the Antarctic Peninsula, and there were people there who'd been there for like two and a half years. And I remember this was 2011 and the iPhone came out in 2009. So there were people there who had never seen an iPhone. And I was like, what? How does that work?
So it's a little bit like a suspended in time.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And they form these, like, they're only 20 people over winter at that station. So, and that means like they are cut off from the outside world for 8 months. There's no ship can go in there, no plane, no nothing. They have to rely on their local medic, and yeah, it's pretty intense. They were very happy when we were the first ship at the end of the winter to get in there. They were pretty excited to see us.
So you say there are about 20 people who overwinter there. How many people are there during what would be the high season? I guess,
yeah,
the warmest.
I think at Rothera, at the time I was there, it was during summer, it grew to about 100, 150 people. You can't really do that much in the winter. You can't really, you know, it's so cold, stormy, snowy, it's dark. So those 20 people are mostly there to just keep the base going. And then most of the scientists, et cetera, come in during the short summer window.
And that 100 plus community, mm-hmm, of people, those are all scientists and researchers?
Mostly, yeah. I mean, there might be, you know, one resident artist if there's a program or... Yeah, but I think...
Mostly
scientists and staff that keep the base going.
And so even though you're all working on different things, do you eat together? Do you have... What is that like?
Yeah, so I've only... Because most of my research is ocean-focused, I spend most of my time on ships. So I only spend a few days at the Antarctic base. But yeah, it's a very strong community from what I could experience. Yeah, everybody eats together, especially the people who overwinter form a very tight-knit community.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with ice and climate physicist Till Wagner. He's leading a team of researchers from Princeton University, UC San Diego, and UNCW, where he works in the Physics and Physical Oceanography Department. The group was recently awarded a grant from the National Science Foundation to study the impact of icebergs on climate. You can ask your own question during this live Wednesday discussion by calling us today at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Till Wagner, you conduct research in a couple of different ways, and one of those, as we talked about, is conducting it what you call in situ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And so what do you gain from actually being there that you couldn't get from satellites?
Yeah, so there's a couple of important reasons to actually go and experience it yourself. So there's this sort of more general idea that if you study the physics of a system and you have the opportunity to actually go there, it can be very helpful to get an idea of how things, you know, we try and understand the physical mechanisms that drive the movement of ice or the melting of ice. And if you've never seen it, it can be a little bit more abstract. So that's one more sort of general reason. Another one that I mentioned earlier is that we still need to carefully ground truth satellite data. So we go there and we measure the reflectivity of ice or the thickness of it, and then compare that to satellite data in order to see how accurate can the satellites be and how can we calibrate them. And then another reason is that satellites can't measure everything, right? So especially with sea ice, which is very thin and it's salty, so the reflectivity is kind of complicated, and it's very complicated to measure the thickness of the sea ice.
What is reflectivity of ice?
Oh, so basically, okay, and this is actually a very important part of why the Arctic sea ice is so important. If you go outside, like today, you would probably choose a white T-shirt and not a black one, because the whiteness of your T-shirt reflects most of the sunlight. Whereas if you pick up a black T-shirt, you'll absorb all that light, right? That's why it's black, because it doesn't send the light back out. And if you absorb the light, you heat up. And so the Arctic sea ice acts a little bit like a refrigerator ice plate on top of our planet. Because it's so white, it sends back a lot of the incoming energy of the sun. If you replace that huge ice area with open ocean instead, the ocean is much darker, so you will absorb a lot more solar heat, so that's maybe one of the main reasons why we care so much about the Arctic sea ice, because it essentially lifts that insulating lid off the top of our planet.
We have a question from Hap. He says, the Earth has been through, I think, maybe 12 or more ice ages. The coast of North Carolina used to be some distance offshore, and there was a shallow ocean over most of eastern North Carolina. Mm-hmm. How does this factor in to determine climate change and sea level rise? He also writes, when I hear about recorded temperature changes over the last 100 years or so, I wonder why not several thousand years might be more relevant. Isn't that just a question of when we started recording temperatures?
So we look a lot to past climates to understand the future. It gives us a really good idea of what the climate is doing by by examining what happened during the last ice age. For example, and yes, during the last ice age, global sea levels were up to 100 meters or so lower than they are now. So you had a lot of the shelf, the land shelf, that's inundated now, that's under the ocean now, was exposed back then. Over the last 8,000 years or so, the sea levels have been, so this is, you know, after the last ice age, the sea levels have been extremely steady. And we know now that that the level of sea level, the rate of sea level rise is faster now than over the last 3,000 years. So, you know, that, so we do try and look further and further back. And some of these things are more difficult to examine than others.
It's interesting, and we have a couple of minutes before we go to break, so we're going to get to Professor Dylan McNamara in the next segment. But I want to ask you just about this whole notion of studying the behavior of icebergs and their impact on the climate. Mm-hmm. This is relatively new that researchers are saying, oh, icebergs are a factor and how they behave.
Yeah.
Has it? Why is this new?
Yeah, so basically, the way that we try and project the future of our climate is by modeling it with computer simulations. And as our computers have become more and more powerful, we can incorporate more and more detail. And, you know, the first models were very simplified versions with ocean and winds. And as we narrowed further and further down, we look at it more and more detail. And so the icebergs are one of those details that we're starting to add in right now.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a look at the impact of icebergs on climate. Till Wagner is leading a research team with scientists from Princeton and UC San Diego to further answer some of these questions. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from Professor McNamara. More of your questions and comments. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're exploring the implications of the melting Antarctic ice on sea level rise and the global climate, as well as the behavior of icebergs and their impact on climate. Ice and climate physicist Till Wagner is with us today. He's in UNCW's Department of Physics and Physical Oceanography, and he's leading a multi-institutional team, which includes scientists from Princeton and UC San Diego. He's also answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few more minutes to get your question or comment in. Professor Dylan McNamara of UNCW, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, how you guys doing? I couldn't resist calling in. Sorry.
I'm so glad to hear from you.
Yeah, my pleasure. So I have actually two questions. The first one, what can I do to develop this radio voice and accent so I can sound more professorial like Dr. Wagner?
So you're telling him he does, in fact, sound professorial, but accessible, right?
I just can't beat it. Yeah, it sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I think so, too. That's what I'm telling him during the break.
My second question, actually, so I sort of have a lay interest in this, and the interest that I have is, and I think the audience might not appreciate this, so I was going to ask Dr. Wagner to comment on some of the geopolitical implications of having no sea ice in the Arctic. I think it's something people don't often think about. Just in their minds, they might say, okay, there's going to be no ice up there, whoop-de-doo, but it's a significant geopolitical, it will have a significant geopolitical impact. And if you could comment on that, I'd love to listen to it off air.
Great question. Thank you so much, Professor McNamara.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that is, I'm actually very glad that this question was asked. It it has potentially, okay, so you have to think of the Arctic as you know, it's an ocean that has been ice covered ever since, you know, humanity has done anything, and now suddenly you take that ice cover off and we call it a new ocean, and so that has huge ramifications, not only for the climate and for the animals that live there, but also socioeconomic and geopolitical, because it essentially, so it opens up shipping lanes. So there's a huge interest from an economic point of view.
So economically, there's an advantage.
There can be an advantage
in one way.
And because you now can go straight from Canada to Siberia, or from Alaska across the Arctic. This is, you know, like up to now, you still need icebreakers for most of those routes to protect the tankers that go through there. But we have started going through these regions that were previously inaccessible. Geopolitically, it means that suddenly you have an accessible border between countries, rivaling countries, because the Arctic, Alaska, the US and Russia have stakes in that ocean, and that opens the possibility for friction. And I know that the Department of Defense, for example, has there's a lot of interest in making sure that we know what are the ramifications on a political, geopolitical scale that come with the opening of the Arctic Ocean.
I want to go back to just the fact that this study of iceberg behavior is kind of a new element of the study of climate change, or the effect on mm-hmm. on the global climate. What are some of the other components just that go into this? And you're not a climate change scientist. You prefer to be referred to as an ice and climate physicist. Mm-hmm. So understanding that, that your science is kind of one component of the science mm-hmm. that underlies climate change understanding.
Yeah. I mean... What like?
Can you tease out an element, for instance, and say this element is discrete? It doesn't affect any other part of,
right.
of the globe.
Yeah, you probably can't, right? Like, I've compared the global climate to a puppet with thousands of strings in the past. So every component of the climate is interlinked and it's complicated, so we tend to just study individual components as individual researchers, and then we come together and try and, you know, connect the individual points. It's complicated, but it's also that makes it so interesting. My component happens to be the ice and its combination with the atmosphere and with the ocean.
In the Arctic, the old ice is disappearing, is the title of an article that was published by the New York Times in May mm-hmm. of this year. Yeah. And it points to the difficulty specifically for narwhals. Mm-hmm. And how, am I pronouncing that correctly?
I narwhals. Think so, yeah.
And how disappearing ice makes it harder for these creatures to hide from their primary predator, the killer whale. Can you explain what these creatures are? And what they look like, and are they now threatened or endangered?
Yeah, you should really talk to my wife about this. She's a marine mammal scientist, also at UNCW. But from what I have learned through conversations with her is, so narwhals, people call them the unicorn of the ocean. They have these quite characteristic long, I think they're, the horns, I'm not sure what you call the or sword, and they are extremely specialized animals. They work, they're very attuned to the way the Arctic sea ice works, essentially. And as the Arctic sea ice changes, there's a question, and it changes so rapidly. You know, we have lost half of the Arctic sea ice over the satellite area. era, so over the last 40 years or so. And the animals have attuned to the sea ice over the course of hundreds, thousands of years. So there's a question of, can they adapt quickly enough to those changes?
How is it affecting the polar bears? You know, we all saw that famous image, probably originally from An Inconvenient Truth, a documentary mm-hmm. about climate change, famously narrated by
yeah.
Al Gore. But is that
yeah,
really?
So these individual, I should maybe say that these individual images can sometimes be a little bit misleading, because polar bears can swim very far, and so sometimes they just stick to a little ice floe that sort of drifts off, and the camera makes it look like this polar bear is forever lost. I've been on an iceberg that was, I don't know, 12 miles from the coast, and there was a ton of polar bears on that iceberg, and I think they were doing okay. Having said that, on a broader scale, on a sort of Arctic basin-wide scale, they are really feeling the retreat of their natural habitat. The sea ice is melting, and so they are being pushed closer together, closer to the shorelines, and we've seen that they are... It looks like they're more likely to go on land, to mix with other bears, to mate with other bears, etc.
And you've talked about the fact that when the icebergs melt, they're injecting all of this cool, fresh water into mm-hmm. the saline ocean, and mm-hmm. that stimulates the growth of phytoplankton mm-hmm. and algae mm-hmm. underneath the sea ice. Do we know how other species besides that sort of basic phytoplankton and
this? That's a very exciting new field of research that we don't really know anything about. So one thing that is maybe worth appreciating about icebergs is that they are extremely difficult and extremely dangerous to study, because they are huge and they break up and they can roll over. And so I've been on an iceberg when it broke up. It's definitely the scariest moment of my life.
Describe that.
Yeah, we were doing a documentary for the BBC, and we had some instruments on the iceberg, and I was on the iceberg with a couple of colleagues, and we got a call through the radio saying there's a huge crack, you've got to get off the ice as quickly as possible, and we basically ran back to the boat, and that iceberg, that huge piece of ice came off. And you know, like, we're really good in like knowing the dangers involved with things like cars and stuff like that. But how do you assess the danger of a piece that's the size of Delaware and moving? It's very difficult, right? Okay, that iceberg was a lot smaller, but it was still like the size of half of Manhattan, which is still a huge piece of ice.
So you would never camp on the iceberg?
I would like to, actually. I mean, it is risky. It's maybe a little bit risky, but you can sort of assess how stable it is, and it would be. I think it would be a really cool experience. But I would definitely not camp near the edge of the iceberg. Let's put it that way. I would definitely like try and stay in the center, where it's maybe a bit more safe.
PBS NewsHour reported on that recent study that we've referenced a couple of times during this discussion that projects sea level rise could go up by three feet by 2100. And they say Antarctica is losing ice three times faster than it was in 2007 as greenhouse gas emissions by human activity contribute to global warming. Is that an established fact from your point of view, that ice melt in Antarctica is a result of human activity, specifically greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes, it is. It is by far the most reasonable explanation, the simplest. And you know, it's we have a strong trend in global mean temperatures and very basic physical concepts, you know, stuff that you could learn in middle and high school, teaches us that rise is caused by increased greenhouse gases. And increased greenhouse gases are due to CO2 emissions. And the vast majority of that is human caused. And ice melts when things get warmer. And so as global mean temperatures go up, ice will keep melting, for sure.
So that's not a political question for you.
No. Yeah. It's, you know, sometimes people ask me, do I believe in global warming? And I'm sort of like, it's not really the right question. Do I believe in gravity? You know, at some point, the evidence is so overwhelming that you just like, yeah, you just have to accept that.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with ice and climate physicist Till Wagner, leading a team of researchers. He's at UNCW, and he's working with researchers from Princeton, UC San Diego. He works in the Physics and Physical Oceanography Department at UNCW, and this multi-institutional group recently was awarded a grant from the National Science Foundation to study the impact of icebergs on climate. You have just a couple of minutes left to get your own question in during this live Wednesday edition. 910-343-1138 is how you do that, or coastline@whqr.org. Till Wagner. By the way, Professor McNamara referred to you as Wagner.
Yeah.
Should I have been saying that this hour?
I've been here for 5 years now, and I'm increasingly transitioning to Wagner. It just makes it easier, because otherwise people always think I spell my name with a V, which I don't.
Right. Okay. So you have said that there is no tipping point in the sense that with ice melt, and we're mm-hmm. talking about ice sheet melt, icebergs, sea ice specifically.
Yeah. Sea ice specifically.
Okay, there's no tipping point. But other climate scientists will say there are different kinds of tipping points.
Right.
For instance, the dieback of the Amazon rainforest, mm-hmm. the collapse of coral reefs. The UN has warned about climate change tipping points. Mm-hmm. Why is there no tipping point with sea ice? What does that mean?
Yeah, so tipping points, it can be a little bit of a difficult concept. The way I use it is in the mathematical sense, which means that something is not reversible. A tipping point is not reversible. Other people define it as something that's like a point of steep acceleration, which is kind of different. Mm-hmm. And so in the Arctic, we had a study where we looked at how the Arctic sea ice would retreat and whether it would come back if we managed to cool the planet down in the future again. And that's kind of a very specific point that we're making there. We're not saying anything that the Arctic will not melt. We're just saying like, okay, you know, over the next 100 years, it might be totally gone in the summer. But if we manage to cool the climate back down again, the Arctic sea ice would come back. That was our conclusion, and that's why we think there's no Arctic sea ice tipping point.
And so whether we could actually cool the planet back down, that is an open question.
That is a very different question, and yeah.
And you're not saying that there is no tipping point as far as cooling the planet back down.
Right. So there might be other, you know, the climate is a very complex dynamical system, and there are certainly tipping points in the sense of non-reversible changes happening in all aspects, not all, but many aspects. But in this very specific sea ice aspect, it's good news, you know? If we manage it through, you know, whatever measures to cool the planet back down, we will get our Arctic sea ice cap back. I'm pretty confident.
So then one of the questions sea ice researchers ask is, because the sea ice is retreating so rapidly right now, will it reach a threshold beyond which it becomes unstable and collapses within a short amount of time? What does collapsing sea ice mean? Does that just mean it's all disappeared?
Yeah, so that's kind of it. You know, it might be collapsing because it has that irreversible tipping point, and we don't see that. Yeah, so in most models, we don't have that type of collapse, but it might accelerate even more and go very rapidly. So, you know, I think the most extreme climate scenarios and climate models predict sea ice loss in the summer during the next 20 years or so. So that sort of timescale, 20 years maybe.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Till Wagner, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager, Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast. Find it on the WHQR app or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.